Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The New Statesman.
Hello, I'm Anoush Shakelian, Britain editor of The New Statesman and host of this podcast. And joining me in the studio, I have our political correspondent, Freddie Hayward, and Hannah Barnes, our associate editor. And this is an episode we like to call You Ask Us. We've been digging around in our virtual mailbag and have brought a couple of your questions that you've sent in to discuss. And here's the first one, which came in via our online form, which you can find in the show notes if you want to ask your own question. Our listener asks, what are the political implications of the CAS report and will it affect how British politicians approach the transgender conversation? So just to contextualise this, this refers to the review by paediatrician Dr. Hilary Cass, commissioned by NHS England in 2020 after a sharp rise in the number of referrals to gender identity services. The review came out yesterday and exposed how children have been let down by a lack of evidence in medical interventions in gender care. Ahead of its publication, NHS England announced that puberty blockers, hormones to stop adolescent development, would no longer be routinely prescribed. And Hannah, you wrote the book Time to Think on the failures of the Tavistock Centre, which was the specialist NHS gender clinic that closed last week, 4 years after it was rated inadequate by inspectors. And our listeners can read your full analysis of the report's findings in your New Statesman piece, which is out online now, which I really recommend that they all read. But, you know, I mean, we won't go through all of the report's findings now because they can go and have a look at your coverage. But our listener is most curious about the political implications of the review. So what have politicians, both in government and opposition, been saying about it so far?
Well, I think what's so striking is that the coverage has been across the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. So not on the front pages of every national newspaper, but on many. And that includes The Guardian, you know, on the firmly on the left, mm-hmm. through The Times, The Mail and The Telegraph. And it also led news bulletins across the BBC all day. Yeah. And was it was mainstream news. And they've all reported this lack of evidence base. Now, if you boil down what that's saying, it's really quite shocking, actually. It's saying that for the last decade and a half, the NHS has allowed the referral and the prescribing of puberty blockers to a group of really vulnerable children who are absolutely distressed, but without any real evidence that they're either clinically safe or effective. Mm-hmm. But I've been struck by that sort of broad coverage, really. And adding to that, we've had Wes Streeting come out for Labour saying we will absolutely make sure all of Dr. Cass's recommendations are implemented. We're going to see this through. He actually said this has been a scandal in the health service. And Rishi Sunak also and other Conservative politicians have said the same. So I think for the first time, it's one of those really rare areas, isn't it, where we do have cross-party consensus that something has gone badly wrong and that both parties are absolutely committed to the same outcome. So I think that that's, well, quite incredible and extraordinary given how much heat there has been over this. And I'm encouraged by the fact that actually finally vast swathes of the British media and British politics are seeing this for what it is, which is a health story. It has always been a health story. It's never been critical of young gender-questioning people or denying their trans identities or even saying people shouldn't transition. It's about whether the care provided to them is safe and effective and the best for them in each and every case. So that's really encouraging. In terms of what other impact it might have politically, I think it's absolutely going to have an impact on two really important areas of guidance slash legislation. So firstly, we have this guidance for schools that's been put out to consultation about how schools deal with this issue, about whether teachers should, well, both affirm their pupils in terms of new pronouns, way they present, where, you know, what facilities they use. Do you allow, you know, those who are born male to use girls' toilets, for example?
These are really, this is social transitioning.
Social transitioning.
Which comes up in the review.
It does come up in the review. And what I like about the review is that Dr. Cass rightly points out that the evidence base for all aspects of gender healthcare are weak, whether that's social transitioning, puberty blockers, or cross-sex hormones. And that means you can't say either way whether it's harmful or whether it's helpful. So there's just nothing there to go on. And so that's why we need more evidence, because, you know, the rule of medicine is first do no harm. So if there's no evidence of benefit, then you shouldn't do it until you have that evidence. With social transition, she said, we don't know. It's not neutral, but we can't tell. The studies that exist, there's not very many of them, and they're not very good. And we can't tell either way whether it's beneficial or harmful. But she has drawn this quite important distinction between younger children who haven't hit puberty yet and older ones who have. And she said that it's likely, I guess, that those who are younger that socially transition is going to have the bigger psychological impact, mm-hmm. because parents have and adults have the greater influence in your life the younger you are. And so she's recommended that you know, schools don't take that decision. She says that is actually a clinical decision, really. And she's recommending that younger children be seen very quickly by these new gender services. So I think that will feed into the school's guidance mm-hmm. as it evolves when the consultation comes back. And then I think the second area is about conversion therapy. Mm-hmm. And this has been really thorny about whether gender identity is included in any ban on conversion therapy when you add that to sexuality. So that's about trying to change someone's sexual identity, or, you know, whether they're gay or bisexual or asexual or whatever, and whether you add gender identity to that. And that the thorniest thing has been about gender identity. Some would argue, if you can't even define something, how can you legislate for it? But the real fear has been that it would preclude, if you had sloppy legislation, it would preclude the very exploration that Dr. Cass is saying that these new gender services for children will have at the heart of them.
Because they'll have a holistic approach,
yeah,
rather
exactly.
than just focus on gender.
So she's saying, you know, medical transition probably will still be right, but for a very small number. Mm-hmm. And for the majority, it won't be. In fact, that will not be the right pathway for them. And so she's advocating, you know, first approach, talking therapies, essentially, and just exploring with a young person all aspects of their life. Because one thing that she's confirmed, which we have known for a long time, is that many of the children contending with gender-related distress also have really some quite other significant difficulties in their life. Maybe depression, anxiety, eating disorders. They might have suffered some trauma. So it's quite hard to see, I think, how any conversion therapy ban going forward, well, I don't think it can ignore that. I'm finding it difficult to see how gender identity is included at all, really, because she has said you must have really strong safeguards against these accusations of conversion therapy. I think it's going to be so difficult to draft that I'm just not sure how you do that, really.
But Anna, could I ask about what the NHS has said in response and what they're going to do? Because are they going to try and address the waiting lists, aren't they? And they're also going to try and expand the services. What are they doing there?
So we've got two new services that opened on the 1st of April, one in London and one in the northwest, based out of Liverpool. A third one's opening in Bristol, hopefully sort of later this year, probably in the autumn. The idea is eventually to have eight, but those will not be the only thing. So what Cass is envisaging is a whole kind of network model where you have those are the kind of final destination, if you like, but not all children on the waiting list will need to go there. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of the idea is that you have some triaging And certainly my understanding is at the moment that the children on the waiting list at the moment, of which there are 5,000 to 6,000, which is appalling, and they've been waiting for years without any access to any help whatsoever, which is disgraceful. But they are going to be seen by CAMHS, mm-hmm. by Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, to kind of assess where they're at and what kind of level of help they need. Because not everybody will, you know, there are different levels of distress, there are mm-hmm. different levels of need. So the idea is that this, to expand the skill set, because linking those two points between what you've asked Freddie about waiting lists and care and kind of the conversion therapy thing is, the main barrier at the moment, I guess, is getting the right professionals to be willing to work in this area of healthcare, because they're so frightened of A, accusations of conversion therapy, but B, of just not being covered and not having any guidance of what good care looks like. And what Hilary Cass has said is, look, you have the skills, like decent mental health professionals, those who work with children with neurodiversity, those who work in safeguarding, those who work in general mental health, you have those skills. That's what you do on an everyday basis. So please come and work here. And that's what she was saying, like, we need to just let them work, take the toxicity out. Mm. And so the idea is, if you have more people who already work in these related fields, that then you can expand care quickly. But I spoke to Dr. Cass on publication of the report, and she said, you know, she's under no illusions. This isn't going to happen overnight. It's going to take several years to roll it out. In terms of how NHS England have responded, I mean, pretty robustly, thankfully. And, you know, I think there's been no acknowledgement of how badly they've failed in the past, but they do seem to be committed to making things better. They've already demanded that the adult gender services, which rather shamefully refuse to hand over patient data to try and help add to the evidence base, mm-hmm. that they must do that. They've said that they are going to urgently review adult gender care services as well, that they've asked them to pause any first appointments for those under 18, because you can go to adult services at 17 because of what Dr. Cass has said about the evidence base with hormones, about how we should proceed with extreme caution. So the mood music is, well, positive in terms of safety. I don't think there are many positives for all those young people waiting for care, and they've been very badly let down.
And when you mentioned CAMHS, it sort of rings a warning bell, because it's so stretched.
It is so stretched. And that has been part of the problem in the past. I mean, many mistakes were of the Gender Identity Development Service, GIDS's own making, mm-hmm. but not all of them, for sure. And one of the difficulties was that when a young person who had difficulties in their lives, including gender, appeared at CAMHS,
yeah.
As soon as they said the word gender, sometimes, understandably perhaps because of a lack of resources, they just palmed those children off onto GIDS. But that meant that all those other things were never dealt with, because they weren't dealt with at GIDS either. So it's going to be very difficult. I mean, NHS England seemed to be committed to putting in the resource that's necessary. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that translates into CAMHS funding, but I mean, really, it's a wider question, and it was Dr. Cass raised this quite considerably, that this isn't just about gender care. This is about actually a crisis in youth mental health services more broadly.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's something Labour has picked up quite a bit, hasn't it, with its pledges to have mental health hubs in every community and every school as well.
Yeah, it has. I mean, just on Labour, I don't think we should be surprised about Wes Streeting's comments.
No, he's been on this for a long time.
A general shift on this topic for quite a while. We had back in, I think it was July last year, when Labour quite quietly dropped their commitment to introducing self-ID for trans people. And that was the sort of start, I think, in the move, both in terms of tone and language, but also in terms of policy. Wes Streeting this week has come out and said that he would no longer, or suggested that he would no longer say, you know, trans women are women. So that there has been a huge shift, and I think that fits into the broader sort of rejection of the what you could sort of categorise as, you know, social progressivism in Keir Starmer's Labour. I think they do see it as a risk, and they've tried to move both towards the government on you know on transgender issues, but also on you know other social, racial politics and you know issues of social justice, because that's how many people see this issue. So I think that it fits into a broader. Maybe they shouldn't.
I would take issue with that.
They like to describe themselves as socially conservative.
But people do see it in those terms. Maybe they shouldn't, but they certainly do in terms of the politics, I think this issue that
Cass has been addressing is very separate. I mean, obviously they're linked, but I think it is separate to trans women in women's prisons, self-ID, because, as I say, it's about children are actually not mini adults. They're children. And this is about not about how you identify, because, of course, you respect people's identity. It's about whether you give drugs off-label that are potentially life-changing without a decent evidence base. And I think that is very different to talking about adults and, you know, a balance of rights. And I think it is perfectly compatible to have respect for trans people and to think nothing other than they deserve dignity and to live their lives free of harassment and access to good healthcare, but also think that the medical transitioning of children is a completely separate issue.
Yeah, completely, but that's not always how it's seen in politics.
Fair enough.
Yes, yeah. And we do need to move on to our next question. But just lastly, you mentioned, Dr. Cass mentions the I think she calls it the exceptional toxicity of this subject in her review, and how actually that, you know, that actually held professionals back from openly discussing their views about it, or even, you know, taking on young people who were coming to them with these issues as mental health patients or for autism screenings and things like that. But the toxicity has also played into the political debate as well. And I wonder if you think that this growing consensus that the Cass Review has brought about, that you've just articulated to us, will stop politicians playing political football with the debate so much. I mean, we spoke about Rishi Sunak, you know, telling Keir Starmer he can't define what a woman is at PMQs every given chance. I mean, do you think that stuff will die down a bit now that there's a bit more of a mainstream sort of consensus?
I mean, I would hope so, but I mean, there are still Labour politicians completely dismissing Cass yesterday, which was pretty disappointing. And I can't see how they've actually read it from the tweets. To me, don't imply that they've read it. But I mean, what do you think, Freddie?
Just to flip the question on its head, I think some people would rightly argue that it's not been a culture war the whole time.
Yes,
you know, just to say that the culture war might end, I think, goes against the findings of the report, because the report suggests that this is a real issue that politicians have rightly raised over the years. And maybe it's, you know, those accusations that sometimes Labour hasn't taken it seriously have been justified. And I think, you know, Wes Streeting and the party leadership have moved their position, which makes it seem as if they accept that argument. So I don't think we can always constantly frame things in culture war terms, because whenever people say it's a culture war,
it's a political football.
I mean, it is, but so is everything. I mean, I don't think that should distract from the argument that there has been a genuine split on this issue for quite a few years.
In both parties.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Hannah. That was really great. And after the break, Freddie, it's your turn to ask your question. Can you give us a clue on what you've chosen?
Yeah, Donald Trump and Keir Starmer.
Unlikely bedfellows.
Well, let's see.
If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back after this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, Freddie, what question have you got for us?
So this is a question from Luke, who asks, could a Starmer win in the UK and a Trump win in the US spell the end for the special relationship?
Well, this is a good question. It's obviously a conversation that's happening within Labour as well. I mean, Trump is a thin-skinned character, and there's a lot of prominent Labour politicians who will still be around, probably. if he wins the election, who have condemned him. I mean, Sadiq Khan is an obvious one who's clashed with many times. But then more significantly, David Lammy, now Shadow Foreign Secretary, likely to be the next Foreign Secretary, who campaigned against his state visit when he was president and has called him a racist KKK Nazi sympathiser, women-hating neo-Nazi sympathising sociopath and a profound threat to the international order. And I think even Donald Trump wouldn't take those descriptions as a compliment. And Keir Starmer himself, you know, early on in his leadership, he told Boris Johnson to go and tell Donald Trump about the UK's abhorrence at Trump's response to George Floyd's death and the subsequent protests around it. And he also said responsibility lay with Trump for the Capitol riots as well. And even recently, he sort of implicitly criticised Trump's suggestion that NATO nations that don't pull their weight are sort of fair game for Russia by saying, I will always stand up for our allies, even if others threaten not to. So there is quite a lot of antagonism there, I think. And I actually asked John Healey about this, Shadow Defence Secretary, when I interviewed him. And it was really interesting because he was such a well-rehearsed and smooth interviewee. You know, he's a real veteran. He's been around for nearly 30 years. But on this question, when I put to him Lammy's comments, he actually paused for ages. I even had to put pause in the transcription to remind myself to try and think about what to say. And he didn't deny that there would be challenges in the US-UK relationship. And he also said it will require a good deal of work for a new government, i.e. a Labour government, and the relationship needs to be renewed. So he didn't deny that it might be tricky, but he did emphasise that Labour will want to keep the US as its closest security ally and vice versa. So clearly the focus will be on diplomacy rather than...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, just to question whether there is a special relationship, I think sometimes when you ask Americans whether that exists, they say what special relationship.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure there's much to end there. Of course, the US and the UK have a close relationship, and I don't think that's going to change if Starmer gets into number 10 and Donald Trump goes into the White House. I think, as you just laid out, Anoush, there are so many quotes which could annoy someone like Donald Trump, who's so thin-skinned. But from Labour's perspective, they're going to be, I think, extremely pragmatic about this going forward. David Lammy and Keir Starmer have been very clear that they're not going to be sanctimonious or moralistic, or look at Donald Trump and say he's so morally repugnant, we're not going to engage with him.
Yeah,
they're not going to do that. They've been very clear that their foreign policy will be very practical. We've seen that with David Lammy. I think he's been on 44 trips abroad since he got the role. You've seen it with his remarks about India, about how close he wants to work with Modi. And I think there is a humility in Labour's foreign policy at the moment. I think they'll look at concepts like Global Britain, like the Indo-Pacific shift that the Conservatives have instituted in the past few years, and say, well, that's probably beyond our means a little bit, and we should also recognise that many parts of the Global South have been extremely annoyed with how we treated them during the pandemic. There's also concerns about how Britain's support for Israel in recent months has isolated some people, some countries in the Global South. So there's sort of the challenges that the David Lammy and Keir Starmer are going to be grappling with. I don't think they're going to let a Donald Trump presidency stop them from collaborating with the White House. It's just potentially whether the White House has a different view on that.
Yeah, and there is a pragmatism in terms of, I think Healey was saying this to me as well, whoever wins, whether it's Biden or Trump, the US is sort of departing the scene in terms of Ukraine, and the UK and other NATO countries will have to step up a bit more in terms of their role there. So there's definitely a shift towards a focus on Europe, no matter who will be in the White House.
Yeah, completely. I mean, this is central to what Labour want to do once they get in, both in terms of defence and foreign policy. They've said quite explicitly they want to get a European security pact done on the back of a German security pact, which will include greater cooperation over trade and supply chains and training and long-term planning. So that's going to be their immediate focus, and I think they want to see that happen quite quickly. Of course, that in a way gives them a little bit more security in the face of Russia's threat, even if Donald Trump either withdraws support for NATO or, you know, is less inclined to come to their defence. So that's certainly going to be their priority. But also it shows that they're going to be less focused on the Indo-Pacific. I mean, of course, it's a really important region. And David Lammy's been there. We've just seen Catherine West, the shadow Asian minister, go to China. So they're going to be highly engaged in that regard. But they've also been quite clear that the focus needs to be on Europe straight away.
Yeah. And it's worth mentioning, actually, our political editor, Andrew Marr, has a piece in the issue that's out this week on Labour's foreign policy plans. And he reports that Lammy, who is already well connected in Washington, has been speaking to Republicans. So he mentions the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, the Ohio senator and author of Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance, who we had an interview with recently, who could be Trump's running mate, who's one of the figures tipped to do that, and the former Trump National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, as well. So he has been making links with Republicans there. And he also reports what you hinted at, Freddie, which is sort of Labour is saying, well, if we're not too snooty about Trump, then, you know, we can rely on his transactional instincts for him to sit down with Starmer and realise that it's, you know, it's worth, you know, having a relationship with a Labour-led UK government to find ways towards a free trade agreement, even.
Wow.
I mean, that seems quite ambitious.
It does seem quite ambitious. I think the Trade Department have, and especially when Liz Truss was there, has recognised that they're more likely to get agreements with individual states than they are with the United States. And that seems to be in the priority. We've also got this India trade deal going on at the moment. Jonathan Reynolds, Labour's shadow business secretary, was actually in India this year to try and to show that Labour would still be committed to the deal, because the Conservative government has had some trouble getting it over the line, which is not what they hoped at all. So, yeah, so there's lots of priorities, but I think you're right, again, to draw out the connections between so many in Labour's team and Washington DC and the establishment there. David Lammy went to Harvard Law School. Keir Starmer worked very closely with the White House when he was DPP, both over extraditions and with the Department of Justice and their Africa strategy. There were lots of connections there, which essentially just means that they know the people, they know the scene. We saw Rachel Reeves go to Washington and meet with Janet Yellen, the US Secretary for the Treasury. So I think they're going to be quite comfortable. We've got to remember that it's not just the relationship between the Prime Minister and the President and the matters. It's the relationship between your Foreign Secretary, but also your Foreign Office, your Security Services, your Trade Departments, your DOJs, your Ministry of Justice, your
central banks.
Your banks, everything. So it all works together. And I think so many of those connections sort of transcend the day-to-day political churn that we often focus on.
Well, thanks to everyone who submitted questions. We do read them all, so please keep them coming in. If you'd like to send us one, you can go to newstatesman.com/youaskus. And if you're listening on Spotify, just scroll down on the episode page and leave a reply. And YouTube viewers can drop a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me and my colleagues Freddie Hayward and Hannah Barnes. We'll be back tomorrow discussing the Angela Rayner tax story. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Trust in politics is broken. So can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.